Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. The question that I want to address most immediately is one that I believe requires urgent analysis, conversation, and perhaps decisions. And who better to have a conversation with about them than one of our most valued contributors, one of the people whose insights and opinions about the Chinese Communist Party, its intentions, its capabilities, and what they mean for us, than our friend Gordon G. Chang. He is the author of a number of important books, including The Coming Collapse of China, as well as a very, very voluble contributor to the public policy debate on these, among other matters, in places like the Gatestone Institute and Epoch Times and Newsweek. He is a valued contributor to and respected advisor for, among other things, our Committee on the Present Danger, China. And we very much appreciate his taking the time to be with us today. Gordon, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank, and Merry Christmas.
And to you too, my friend. Let me start, Gordon, by setting the stage for this conversation, because we may not agree on all of its particulars, but I think it's important that we talk about them. The Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping is under great stress. I think there's no doubt about that. You've talked about it here and elsewhere. We've also talked about how, under such circumstances, totalitarians are often given to lash out, to seek some foreign adversary, even a boogeyman, to justify both increased oppression at home and divert attention to other issues besides their own internal difficulties. Given all of that, the United States at the moment is led by a man who I believe is properly described as a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party. And although he has repeatedly made claims that, you know, if Taiwan were invaded by the CCP, we would have to defend the island. And yet each time he said that, his administration has very expressly walked back the statement. All of this raises a question, Gordon, against the backdrop of what I call strategic arson by Xi around the world, Ukraine, Israel, now shipping war south of the Middle East, possibly shooting in Latin America, Venezuela against Guyana, possibly North Korea against South Korea. He's roughing up the Philippines. In other words, you combine all of that with the possibility of, you know, some kind of violent assaults inside our own country. The question to you is Xi Jinping looking to engage militarily, preferably without fighting, but nonetheless militarily, to seize Taiwan after its presidential election early next year, confident that he's got both things under control, or he can under control his population, and also to sort of distract and attenuate any possible resistance on our part to such an aggressive act against Taiwan.
Well, to add to your list as an initial matter, we have to put in North Africa, where China and Russia have been fielding insurgencies that look like wars. And perhaps the next war will be Algeria against Morocco. But apart from that, I believe that Xi Jinping, he talks about war all the time, no question about it. He certainly is preparing China to go to war. We know they're engaged in belligerent activities in the Himalayas against India, against Japan, in the East China Sea, around the Senkakus or Diaoyus, and most notably against the Philippines, where there are extremely belligerent activities, some of them constituting acts of war at Second Thomas Shoal, Whitsun Reef, and Scarborough Shoal. But the question you asked is Taiwan. And the question there, of course, is a large-scale military invasion. And I don't see that for quite some time for a number of reasons. First of all, the Chinese military is in no shape to launch a coordinated air-land-sea attack, something that China has never done in its history. And the Chinese military right now is hit by turmoil at the top. So, for instance, in the rocket force, which Xi Jinping would rely upon because he's going to threaten to use nuclear weapons and maybe actually use them, we know that the top two commanders have been replaced this summer. Maybe about 70 officers and other personnel have been removed in the most recent months. This is a branch of the Chinese military which is not capable of fighting right now. The other sign that we have is the defense minister. General Li Shangfu has not been seen since August 25th in public. He was formally replaced on the 24th or the 25th of October. He has not been replaced. Now, the defense minister is not a war-fighting post, but for China, propaganda is really important. The defense minister is China's relations to other militaries around the world, and they're not ready to go to war if they don't have a defense minister. Plus, one other thing. The Chinese know that they get about 60% of their oil from the Middle East. They have no way to protect it as it goes across the Indian Ocean. So I don't think China is ready for a large-scale military invasion against Taiwan anytime soon. That's not to say they won't go to war. They can go to war for the reasons you mentioned, which is Xi Jinping has domestic imperatives to do that. But I think that if he does choose war, it's going to be against a small country, which he thinks he can take, not Taiwan, which would be a much more difficult thing. One more point, Frank. In order for China to launch an invasion of Taiwan, for that to be successful, he needs a blockade. For that blockade to be successful, it's got to include sovereign Japanese territory, which means that in Xi Jinping's mind, in the Chinese military mind, they know that if they go to war against Taiwan, they're also going to war against Japan and the United States. And I don't think the Chinese military at this point really wants to do that.
Yeah. There's so much there to, you know, suss out. Gordon, I respect your opinion very highly, as you know. And I think you're certainly right on a couple of key points. The mass firing of military personnel, and it's not just the rocket forces, I believe. Other branches are also being purged. The question, I guess, is one of, so does that mean that Xi has people stepping up into those positions in whom he has complete confidence, or at least over whom he has complete control in his estimation? And does the absence of a defense minister suggest that he really envisions running this thing himself in his capacity as, you know, chairman of the Central Military Committee or whatever they call it? Are those considerations that should be borne in mind, Gordon, to offset perhaps a bit of susceptibility to the idea that this just can't possibly happen at this time?
We don't know about the firings. There are three theories. One of them is that Xi Jinping has replaced people who he felt were disloyal. The other is that Xi Jinping has actually been, his people have actually been replaced by his enemies. And there's some evidence for that. And the third theory is that Xi Jinping has just become a paranoid. So he's sacking his own people with really no reason. And at this point, one can argue for all three theories.
Paranoid is a very troubling thing to have in an adversary, as we know from hard experience with Stalin. Gordon, hold the thought. We're going to come right back with more with the great Gordon G. Chang. Follow him, as I do, at Twitter, at that handle, Gordon G. Chang. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. The This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party's totalitarianism is on display as it resumes today the prosecution of Hong Kong's most prominent incarcerated freedom fighter, Jimmy Lai, this time for sedition. Mr. Lai's fate is one he shares with over 7 million people of the former British colony whose freedom the communists falsely promised to respect for 50 years. Like him, they are now enslaved, albeit in an open-air prison. Jimmy's conviction, which is all but guaranteed by Hong Kong's Beijing-rigged judicial system, is meant to further tighten the screws on the former territory's citizens and telegraph what awaits those of Taiwan. A new documentary entitled The Hong Konger powerfully illuminates Jimmy Lai's courage and sacrifice for freedom. It also shows what the Chinese communists have in mind for us as well. Join the fight to free Jimmy Lai by watching HongKongerMovie.com. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're visiting with the great Gordon G. Chang. He is one of our duty experts on all things China, and we've been talking with him about who's right. You know, should we be concerned that Xi Jinping is intent on and capable of going to a shooting war, and under what circumstances? And some of the factors that Gordon has offered that may suggest not so much. And Gordon, one of those was this issue of the purges of his military and his own desire and seeming ability to exercise control over it. Finish that thought, if you would.
Yes. General Li Shangfu, the defense minister who was canned, was a Xi Jinping appointee. And so are the senior leaders of the Rocket Force, who have all been installed recently, and they've been removed. And that suggests a couple things. One of them is that Xi Jinping is the paranoid, which was the third theory that we talked about. And you got to remember, you know, you're absolutely right. We got to be deeply concerned about that, because here you got a country which is fast building up its nuclear weapons arsenal. And if he descends into darker versions of the world, we're in for a failure of deterrence. But the other things that, if you look at the Chinese military right now, we know that a couple things. One of them is that Xi Jinping this year has been purging general officers who are opposed to going to war. That, of course, is a really dangerous sign. And most prominent among them is General Liu Yaozhou, the former Air Force general, considered to be China's foremost military thinker. He was reportedly given a death sentence this early in late winter. I don't know if that is true or not, but the point is he has been disappeared. And we know that other officers who did not think invading Taiwan was a good idea have disappeared. That also suggests Xi Jinping is planning to go to invade Taiwan soon. But on the other hand, you know, a lot of these people, they are Xi Jinping people. They have disappeared. And that really raises the whole issue of maybe it is Xi Jinping's enemies dealing with his people. And we see echoes of this in the purges of civilians, which really can't be explained by a strong Xi Jinping. The one thing that we know, Frank, is that there is extreme turmoil in the Communist Party, both in the civilian and military ranks. And these things don't happen in the absence of severe infighting. So that is the baseline. We can put a lot of different theories on it, and we should explore them all. But the point is that right now, China is in a period of intense infighting at the top. And this has occurred at a number of different times in its history, and we've seen what's happened then.
Well, I think what you've said seems to me to further reinforce some of my concerns, Gordon. In addition to possibly being a paranoid, we certainly, I think, now have abundant evidence that he's a pyromaniac. And the combination of those two makes for some very sporty moments and demands, as you say, on our part, heightening of our deterrence in every way we possibly can. I wanted just to ask you to drill down a bit and briefly, if you would, on the geography of a effort to blockade the island of Taiwan, necessarily infringing upon sovereign Japanese territory. The Japanese have made it very clear that if China goes to war with Taiwan, they're going to have to contend with the Japanese as well. But explain this this linkage, if you would, as a partial justification for that.
Yeah, there are Japanese islands that are actually south of Taipei. Japan is generally north of Taiwan. But there are Japanese islands that are actually south of Taipei. So, for instance, Yonaguni, which is within 58 nautical miles of the main island of Taiwan. And on a clear day, actually, you can see the mountains of Taiwan from Yonaguni. This is so close that most military analysts believe that in order to have a blockade of Taiwan be effective, you got to include Yonaguni, and there are associated islands there. So in a sense, the Japanese archipelago and Taiwan, they form a unified chain. So you got to go after both of them if you go after one of them. Now, this is something where the Japanese think a lot about, of course, because a blockade, including Yonaguni and associated islands, would be an act of war.
You'd certainly think so. And whether that enters into the calculation or whether it's all baked into what Xi has in mind, I guess we will be watching closely with your good help, Gordon. Let me pivot in the last couple of minutes we have to something else that was happening in the course of the day today. Jimmy Lai has been brought back to trial, this time on what amount to charges of sedition. Gordon, talk a little bit about Jimmy. I don't know if you've seen this new film, The Hong Konger, about his life and his struggle for freedom and the sacrifices he's made for it. But also what the CCP is both signaling by this further prosecution of a man who's already been, incarcerated for some 3 years, I guess, at this point. And for the people of Hong Kong, obviously, but perhaps of Taiwan, yeah, and us.
The first day of his trial, Monday, was the 1,081st day of incarceration of Jimmy Lai. He's being prosecuted under the Beijing-imposed national security law for two things. One of them is seditious activity, conspiracy to commit sedition, and the other conspiracy to talk to hostile foreign parties, in other words, us. And this trial is going to has been delayed for a year, which is really interesting in and of itself, because I think that there has been disagreement inside the Hong Kong government as to what to do. But clearly, Beijing controls it now. He's going to trial. That trial is supposed to last 80 days. He's going to be convicted. He faces a life sentence. He's just turned 76. So even the in terms of imprisonment that he have could very well be a life sentence, not to mention what he can get under this. This is a test for Hong Kong, and it's also a test for Biden, President Biden, because remember, there were very few planks of the Democratic Party platform in 2020 that related to China, but one of them was freedom and democracy in Hong Kong. So we need to do everything we possibly can to get Jimmy out of Hong Kong into freedom. He purposefully stayed because he did not want to abandon the cause. So he's a real hero for freedom, not only in Hong Kong, not only in China, but everywhere. And we have to do everything we possibly can on his behalf.
One other aspect of this that I think you did not explicitly mention, but in addition to everything you did say about him, he's a billionaire, a self-made, eminently successful man who didn't have to put himself in the crosshairs of the Chinese Communist Party by helping lead and underwrite, to some extent, I guess, some of the demonstrations for freedom in Hong Kong. And again, this is captured very powerfully in this new film, The Hong Konger, produced by the Acton Institute, and I commend it to all of you. It's available for free Google it, the Hong Konger about Jimmy Lai. And Gordon, I guess just any thoughts on what we could be doing specifically besides becoming part of a campaign to free Jimmy Lai, which is at the end of that film, that might actually bring about his release?
Well, what I would do is I'd increase the tariffs on the imports of Chinese goods. I say, look, okay, you want to go ahead with the trial of Jimmy Lai? We're putting 50% tariffs on every Chinese item that comes into our country. Other thing that I would do, we have, since the Tariff Act of 1930, we do not permit in our country the products made by forced and slave labor. Many, many Chinese products are. We need to enforce those laws. And I would do that right now.
Right now, and make it explicitly tied to this particular enslaved individual, Jimmy Lai, and his freedom. Gordon, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you for this very important conversation, the clarifications that I think you've brought to where we stand. Keep up the great work, my friend, at the Gatestone Institute and elsewhere. Come back to us as soon as you can. In the meantime, Merry Christmas. We'll be right back
Merry Christmas.
Right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to welcome once again Dr. Scott Powell, a friend and colleague of many years, a senior fellow of a highly esteemed organization, the Discovery Institute out in Washington State. Scott is a very prolific contributor to the public policy debate, notably through many books, including one of my personal favorites from early on in his career, Covert Cadre, and more recently, Rediscovering America, in which he talks about what we can learn from our national holidays, about the nature of our country and the best of it. Scott Powell, it's great to have you back. Welcome once again, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be with you, especially at this time.
Yeah, it's a time such as this, as they say. You have been for quite a while now raising an alarm about an effort underway that almost begs belief, incredulity. It's a campaign that has been mounted by some, well, I believe, Marxists, including inside the United States Pentagon, to purge memorabilia statues, especially of the Confederacy. There is one example of what they consider to be such memorabilia that they are in the process of trying to destroy, in all places, an Arlington National Cemetery. Tell us about it, and what's the animating force behind this idea?
Well, I'd remind the audience that Arlington National Cemetery is the most hallowed ground in all of America. It's sacred ground. It turns out that the Reconciliation Monument has really become a lightning rod, and I believe that it can be a turning point in this woke revolution. So let me take a moment and explain how it came about. The United States was fought its most bloody war in the Civil War. You know, more lives were lost, and there was ill will and really ongoing acrimony between the North and the South. Reconstruction did not go well. Of course, Lincoln was assassinated. Johnson was his successor. He was really not a good president, not a good substitute for Lincoln. Didn't have the compassion. Alienated the South. Reconstruction really was a dismal failure. And for 30 years, this division existed. Well, it turns out that William McKinley was the president when the Spanish-American War broke out. And it turns out that a lot of the enlistees and officers to fight that war came from the South, came from the former Confederate area. And they fought so valiantly side by side with Northerners and soldiers from all over the country that the war ended very quickly in less than 4 months. McKinley saw this as an opportunity to celebrate the unity of America and the reconciliation. So he conceived of this monument. Of course, he was assassinated in early 1900s. I forget when, 01, I think. He was succeeded by Teddy Roosevelt, and Roosevelt also supported the idea of reconciliation very much so. He paid tribute to the South. He paid tribute to Robert E. Lee. And then Howard Taft came along, and Howard Taft actually was the one under his administration. It came together with a sculptor being chosen, Moses Ezekiel. He was a Jewish cadet from a Virginia Military Academy. He fought in the Confederacy, but he was a very talented sculptor. And he threw his heart and soul into making this, designing, crafting this incredible monument. It's 33 feet tall, out of bronze. It took him years to do it, but it was completed. And then it finally was unveiled under Woodrow Wilson. So we had four presidents supporting this great cause. And as it turns out, every president afterward laid a wreath at the Reconciliation Monument on Memorial Day, right up through the first year of the Obama administration. So if all these presidents can get behind reconciliation, which is what America is all about, as a matter of fact, I was appalled that they would do this at this season, because some people have called the Reconciliation Monument the Christmas Monument, because Christ came into the world to bring reconciliation between sinners and God, right? So,
when you say do this, what you're talking about is there is a crane in place. I think we've got pictures of both the statue and the crane that is designed to remove it, that is part of this larger campaign that I mentioned. Talk a little bit about this commission.
Let me explain the campaign.
Why it has been operating.
After the George Floyd riots in 2020, the woke revolution really broke out in America. Congress felt they had to do something, right? And whenever Congress feels it has to do something, watch out. They usually do the wrong thing. Or they'll do something symbolic. They really won't address the real problem, and they'll do something else. Well, they created a naming commission to rename all the Confederate bases in the South, thinking that somehow the
Union bases, American military bases.
American military bases that had been named after Confederate officers. Right, Confederate generals. So now the Reconciliation Monument should not have fallen under this, because it is illegal to desecrate grave sites. This is hallowed ground in Arlington. But nonetheless, the woke revolution wants to go as far as they can. And somehow the Reconciliation Monument got ensnared in this bill that was passed, which became law. And we began fighting this well over a year ago. And who
are the we who have been fighting this?
DefendArlington.org is the organization. And I'll give that name toward the end again, so everybody can access it and help support it, because it's very expensive to take legal action. So our first legal effort came to naught. Last week, The judge decided that he wouldn't hear the case, and we were distraught. We were forlorn because we didn't know
the case being to try to prevent the desecration of this statute in violation of the law, which was something that the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, was pushing forward on.
There's also
another aspect to this. There's some legislative language in the House version of the Defense Appropriations Bill that has been passed by the House. Tell us what's in that piece of legislation, which is still, in process.
Well, we got the Good Amendment passed and attached to that. And
Bob Good of Virginia, I believe.
Yes, Bob Good of Virginia. And this prohibits any defense spending to take down any monuments. I believe it may be any monuments, but certainly in Arlington. Arlington was named because we knew what was in the works. So that should have put the Secretary of Defense on notice that this should not go forward. But, I believe that he's part of the woke revolution. He gives every evidence. And
I just have to say, Scott, you keep referring to the woke revolution. I make a point on this program of being more explicit about what that really is.
It is a cultural Marxist revolution. Absolutely.
Exactly. I know you agree with that. And I think we need to be clear.
I wholeheartedly do.
So bring us up to speed at the very moment. Where is the legal battle?
Well, it's almost like we had a Red Sea moment in that, first of all, we learned of another court filing to save the Reconciliation Monument. We hadn't known about it, but there was someone else who felt as we did. They had a court that had a venue. The court accepted the case, and we immediately started, when we learned this Thursday last week, we began, building bridges and saying, look, this monument's going to come down unless we can get a temporary restraining order. You have the court case that's acknowledged by the court, filed in the court, accepted by the court. Let's attach a temporary restraining or an injunction to it because the cranes are coming. Well, we were so fortunate that it all came together and we got a temporary restraining order this morning, probably less than an hour ago.
Wow. And this is as the crane is now on site poised to begin the wrecking operation.
Its crane was above the monument. They were obviously figuring it out, how they were going to do it. It's a very heavy monument. It probably weighs 25 tons.
I can only imagine. Yeah. And inevitably there would be damage done to it in the process, presumably. Yeah. Were they planning on melting it down, as I understand they did with Robert E. Lee's statue?
No, the word was it was going to be taken in by the Virginia Military Institute, VMI. Now, that doesn't really protect it. VMI has also embraced the cultural Marxist revolution.
Has it really? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is so chilling, but praise the Lord that there is an answer to prayer in this case. The temporary restraining order will presumably prevent this kind of extraction and possible damage
generally
period of time. Do we have any idea how long, Scott Powell?
Well, generally, temporary restraining orders stay in place until the disputed matter is adjudicated. And we are prepared, God willing, and funding available to go all the way to the Supreme Court if we have to. If we don't get an adjudication in the lower court, we feel so strongly that this is the Waterloo, the Rubicon, that we've got to stop this divisive, and especially because the military is having recruiting problems now. Why? Because many of the Southern families in particular who had, long generations of military service are now saying, we don't believe that you should make a career in the military until it returns to a merit-based system.
Yes, and amen to all of that. Scott, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Defendarlington.org is where people can learn more about this and contribute, hopefully, to prevent this travesty. Thank you for your work on it, my friend, and for joining us to give us a very, timely update. God bless you. We'll come back
to
this.
Thank you. I sure will.
Merry Christmas. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party's totalitarianism is on display as it resumes today the prosecution of Hong Kong's most prominent incarcerated freedom fighter, Jimmy Lai, this time for sedition. Mr. Lai's fate is one he shares with over 7 million people of the former British colony whose freedom the communists falsely promised to respect for 50 years. Like him, they are now enslaved, albeit in an open-air prison. Jimmy's conviction, which is all but guaranteed by Hong Kong's Beijing-rigged judicial system, is meant to further tighten the screws on the former territory's citizens and telegraph what awaits those of Taiwan. A new documentary entitled The Hong Konger powerfully illuminates Jimmy Lai's courage and sacrifice for freedom. It also shows what the Chinese communists have in mind for us as well. Join the fight to free Jimmy Lai by watching HongKongerMovie.com. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're talking, I'm pleased to say, about Israel next. We're talking about the state of the war in which it has found itself thrust. We're talking about the nature of the enemies that she faces far beyond Hamas in Gaza. And we're going to talk about that and much more with our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, the man who directs its Mideast program. That would be Dr. David Wormser. He brings a wealth of experience in senior government positions at the State Department, the National Security Council, the Vice President's office, not least, and also served as a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy, working on intelligence matters. His considerable capabilities are something we are proud to be able to showcase here, and we're always delighted to have him back. David, thank you. We've got a relatively little time to talk about an awful lot of very important topics. Mm-hmm. Give us, if you would, the update on the state of the war that Israel is.
Well, I think Israel's sort of now entering that long-haul phase of slogging through what is a real mess. And unfortunately, Hamas also understands and is learning tactics. It's adjusting as the Israelis are adjusting, and it's adjusting both to Israeli tactics but global opinion. And it is succeeding in some ways and failing in others. The Israelis are moving slowly forward, carefully, trying to avoid civilians where they can, get hostages freed when they can. They've had a big mistake on Friday, where three hostages were accidentally killed, which is a great tragedy in Israel, and it's caused certainly a mental blow to the stomach, essentially, there. But they're moving ahead, and they're determined to go all the way and to finish off Hamas in Gaza and to bring Gaza under Israeli security control so that this doesn't happen again. In the north, you see a very slow escalation. The Israelis are beginning to initiate operations, not only react to attacks on them. Every day there's a couple dozen incidents, attacks, missiles. Israel responds. Israeli was killed. This is from Hezbollah in Lebanon. An Israeli soldier was killed yesterday there. So the Israelis are beginning to initiate. They're beginning to take to do strikes that begin to strike the infrastructure of the Hezbollah military, the terrorist military. Problem is that Hezbollah has embedded itself in many areas in civilians, just like in Gaza, but also in the Lebanese military. Some of it is embedded in the Lebanese military. And for some mystical reason, I don't understand what, the United States is obsessively concerned with the welfare of the Lebanese military. So they're quite angry at Israel for striking Hezbollah in a way that sometimes overflows and hits Lebanese military assets.
Well, to decode this just briefly, isn't it pretty much the same mindset that brings us this idea that the Palestinian Authority is the solution to Hamas, that if only they prop them up, if only they prop up the Lebanese army, that somehow these terrorists of Hamas and Hezbollah respectively will be made more
manageable. Yeah, the war for the United States is a very narrow one. It's make Palestine safe for Abu Mazen and the PLO, and it's make Lebanon safe for the Lebanese military, both of which are non-existent institutions, both of which are failed institutions, both of which are essentially controlled institutions in the PLO sense.
And controlled by the jihadis of Iran.
Right. And first of all, the Palestinian Authority is essentially answering to the jihadis, but the problem is the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, is controlled by Abu Mazen, who himself is a radical who espouses terrorism, is a bit more sophisticated and refined in restraining himself, but believes in terrorism and Israel's destruction, and jihadis, which essentially dictate the character of the Palestinian Authority. And the same in Lebanon. The Lebanese military now is under the control of the Lebanese government, which is under the control of Hezbollah. This is like talking about the Czech military in the 1960s and 50s. It's a Soviet Union asset at this point. Like the Czech military was. These are not independent actors. They have no agency. Yeah. This is Iran.
So when the Israelis are beginning to take the initiative in offensive actions against Hezbollah, David, they're in effect beginning to attack Iran through this surrogate. Is there any alternative, though, to taking down, to the extent they can, the immense arsenal that Iran has positioned in southern Lebanon, these rockets and missiles estimated to be north of 150,000 of them, capable of raining death and destruction all over the state of Israel?
Yeah, I think there's really two things Israel must achieve in Lebanon. One is, and they amount to a strategic assault on Iran, but the two specific tactical things are, number one, the first 15 or so kilometers or 10 to 15 miles of Lebanon have to be utterly cleaned out of Hezbollah. And that cannot be done from the air. It cannot, in my view, it cannot be done diplomatically, reliably. And there can be no force that is set up that will keep it clean. And namely, UNIFIL already exists. That's what happened in 2006 with the withdrawal of Israel under UN Resolution 1701. Yeah. So the Israelis will have to maintain some sort of positive control, whether it's demilitarization and the Israelis have a proxy army, or the Israelis themselves are there in some form or some capacity. That's one thing. And the second thing is the larger, broader disarmament of Hezbollah from its arsenal. Israel learned on October 7th, don't let your enemies who say they're going to kill you build the means to do so.
Yeah. Especially in quantity like Hezbollah now has.
And then there's the strategic side, which is, at this point, this all boils down to Tehran and Iran and a war with Iran. Mm-hmm. And every act Israel does has to be filtered through that idea. Is it damaging Iran strategically and throwing it onto the defensive? Yeah. That is the most important question for the Israelis.
It's not only the most important question, I would argue, for them, but also for us. And we seem to be getting this completely wrong as well. David, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about American policy. Lloyd Austin is in the theater at the moment, talking to the Israelis about what they must and must not do. We'll get a sense of David's take on all of that right after this. Stay tuned. We're back, and we're continuing a very timely conversation with Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy. He is the duty expert there, and for an awful lot of other people, on national security, especially as it bears on the Middle East. And David, we were talking a bit about American policy and propping up the Lebanese army and trying to make sure that Hamas is replaced by an equally unsavory cast of characters doing business as the Palestinian Authority seem to be two benighted ideas. Another is that Israel must stop attacking civilians, and that somehow it is doing so with abandon, and therefore is now subject to increasing coercive restrictions on access to weapons and perhaps more generally American support, diplomatic and otherwise. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is in Israel as we speak, and presumably delivering that message. And I'm mindful, David, that in World War II, the United States contributed materially to the mass destruction of civilian populations, whether it was in Dresden or in Tokyo or Nagasaki or Hiroshima. And we did it because we felt it was absolutely vital to achieve our war aims. There would be a lot of second guessing and cavilling about it after the fact, but at the time there was no doubt we were going to do what we thought we needed to do. Israel is, by contrast, it seems to me, exercising enormous restraint. The Palestinians claim that 20,000 or so civilians have been killed. I don't believe that number, but even if it were that, it is evidence of enormous care being taken to try to prevent the mass, you know, destruction of civilians in a densely packed population area like Gaza. Your thoughts on all of that quickly, if you could.
Yeah, first of all, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a fraction of the number of civilians killed that the Palestinians say. They literally invent numbers that have no relationship to reality. We do know that lots of terrorists have been killed, and according to their numbers, none have, zero, which is, you know, obviously an invention. My sense is the Israelis probably have killed somewhere around 10,000 terrorists in tunnels fighting with weapons. 2,000 alone were killed on October 7th invading Israel. So there may be a death toll of 10 to 15,000, but the number of civilians killed, innocents killed, are minuscule compared to what the Palestinians are saying. And given the nature of this war and what is happening, I think the Israelis ought to be commended for how they've behaved militarily in saving civilian lives. And there's reasons internally to Judaism and the Israeli image of themselves as to why they're doing it. But the second thing, too, is I would just remind everybody, war is a grisly affair. It costs people their lives, which is why those who start wars are guilty of a tremendous crime. And of course, Hamas started the war, or continued the war that the Arabs have started on Israel since the 20s, before Israel was even created. So again, war is horrible. And in this particular case, you're dealing with the most grisly type of warriors of all. These are genocidal, depraved, sadistic killers, an army of Hannibal Lecters, basically. And we see what they did.
Who believe it is their God's will that they behave in this way,
and they believe
even more dangerous.
Exactly,
it's not just psychopaths.
I just commend everybody to read the letter that Harry Truman wrote at the end of World War II to a friend who wrote to him saying that he's very disturbed by the use of the nuclear weapon on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Truman wrote back saying, "Well, I too am disturbed. It really agonizes me. But to be honest, we're fighting a beast." And when you're fighting a beast, you have to fight them as a beast. You have to treat them like a beast. And in this case, we're dealing with the beast of beasts with Hamas.
And you have to utterly defeat them, which is the position that the United States
took. And generationally, you have to make it clear to the Palestinians. Unfortunately, Palestinians do support Hamas. We see the poll. You have to make it clear to the Palestinians, this is a dead end. This is a dead end.
Yeah, literally. David, let me just turn then to the issue of Iran. And we're seeing another front very aggressively being opened by a group that President Biden, on I think his first day in office, removed from the terrorist list. Those would be the Houthi rebels, as they're called, another proxy of Iran. Talk a little bit about this tanker war, and not so much tanker war, shipping war that has been unleashed by the Houthis, and how that can be managed in a way that doesn't devastate, you know, not just the war effort, but the economies of a great many nations besides.
Well, yes. First of all, Israel's economy is damaged because it has a port in the south, Eilat, that is inaccessible now. And its port capacity on the Mediterranean is filled up. All trade from Asia now has to go all the way through Asia and then around to Israel and the ports in the Mediterranean, which adds a lot of cost to things. But more than that, the port capacity is full. The Israelis now are really facing an economic chokehold. They went to war once over this. 67 was a situation where that was the real trigger for war in 67, was cutting off the south. The Houthis have cut off the Bab al-Mandab. Egypt's economy is going to suffer horribly. About 10 to 20% of its economy is revenue from the Suez Canal, which is shut. And then finally, Europe. I don't remember whether it's 15% or it's somewhere, give or take, 5%. It's about 15% of the world's global sea traffic goes through the Bab al-Mandab Straits, all shut down now. The United States, since its beginning in 1812, the Barbary Pirates, this has been a core mission of the United States' global position. This goes beyond America First, goes beyond liberals, Democrats, Republicans. This is a core American mission, is to keep sea lanes open.
Right. And we're not doing it so much, at least in this region at the moment. I think we've got one vessel that seems to be trying to provide some protection, but clearly more is needed. And clearly that's the point, is to further stress our limited naval and other assets, I think, in furtherance of a Chinese design, which is something we talked about earlier in the program with Gordon Chang. We have to leave it at that. David, thank you for this update. Come back to us for a longer visit next week, if you will. In the meantime, stay well, my friend, and keep up the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. You'll be right. I want to thank you all for joining us. When we come back next time, I hope you'll do so again. Until then, go forth and multiply.